This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a prison cell at the Okeechobee Youth Facility in Florida, 16-year-old Lionel Tate waits to see if he gets his life back. Tate killed a 6-year-old playmate 4 years ago, was tried as an adult, and became the youngest person ever sentenced to life in prison. Yesterday, an appeals court overturned Tate's murder conviction and ordered a new trial. The ruling comes as another young man, Lee Boyd Malvo, faces a possible death sentence in another courtroom nearly 1,000 miles to the north. There are important differences in these two cases, but they both raise the issue of adolescence in the adult justice system. The number of teenage defendants charged with adult crimes continues to increase as science provides new information about the development of adolescent brains. How are the different demands of science and justice playing out in the courtroom? Later this hour, AT&T sets off for the next frontier of telecommunications, internet telephone service. Some people do that already. If you're one of them, we'd like to hear from you. Call us on your internet long distance in about 40 minutes. But now, juveniles and adult courts. What happens to them, and how well are their special needs understood? If you've worked with kids in either the youth or adult courts, we want to hear about your experiences. And if you've raised a teenager or two, when do you think they became old enough to take full responsibility for their actions, and when could they have faced something as complex as a trial? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from her office at the New York Times is Dana Kennedy, who covered the Tate trial for the Times, and thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
In the ruling yesterday, the appeals court in Florida said there was a question of whether Tate should have stood trial in the first place. So what was the issue there?
Well, I think it had to do with his maturity level and why he wasn't given a competency hearing evaluation during the time of the trial. His mother had initially turned down a plea deal that would have given him, I believe, 3 years in a juvenile facility. He would have been out by now. And his current lawyer has said that Lionel did not have the mental capacity, the understanding of what that deal meant, and that his mother, sort of didn't have the right to take such a gamble without him being able to participate in his own defense, and he just didn't know what was at stake. He didn't understand. He was too young.
Now, did that issue come up at all during the first trial?
It did not. There were some psychiatrists for the defense who evaluated him, but they never raised the issue. Now he has a different set of lawyers, and they raised it after the trial.
And are the first set of lawyers explaining why they didn't raise it the first time around?
They're not. They so far haven't said anything about it that I know of.
Mm-hmm. Now, the court did reject defense claims that Tate should never have been tried as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
How did that logic work?
Well, Florida has a history of trying juveniles as adults. As you might well know, there have been three very high-profile cases in recent years of juvenile offenders being tried as adults. The other, the Nathaniel Brazil case, case of a young man, 13 at the time, shot his teacher in school between the eyes, got second-degree murder, and he's now serving 28 years. And then there was a case, last year, Derek and Alex King, 12 and 13-year-old young men who bludgeoned their father to death with a baseball bat and are now serving 7 and 8 years in prison for that crime. So Florida, has a history of prosecuting children as adults, in capital murder cases.
And that the court did not rule on at all. It just let that stand.
Yes.
And just addressed
mm-hmm.
the issue of competency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I understand it, the court also found that there was very little argument with the brutality of the crime that was
That's
committed.
Right. That's right. And the thing is, obviously the prosecutor in this case, who is now in private practice, has been saying since this ruling came down that, the victim should not be forgotten here. A 6-year-old girl who just had unbelievable brutality committed to her before she died. The autopsy pictures I recall from the trial were just horrific. Yet the jury in this case did not know that by convicting him of first-degree murder, he would get life without parole. And so if the jury had known that, I'm not sure if there would have been a different outcome or not. But there definitely was a victim here who suffered a horrible death.
And a death, again, and just going back to the appellate court ruling that they said could not have been an accident. Mm-hmm. These gruesome injuries could not have been caused by accident. Mm-hmm. Now, when you were covering the trial, was Tate engaged? Did he interact?
Oh, not at all. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. I was sitting right behind him, and it was unbelievable. I watched sort of his manner and demeanor. He had no idea, to my mind, what was going on. He doodled on a drawing pad. I think at one point he had either race cars or some, some toys that he was playing with. He looks very different now. He's grown a lot. He looks like a young man. At the time, he looked like, you know, a child. He was a very young child. I think he grasped, I would say, probably a third of what was going on.
And was he talking to his lawyers?
Not much. The lawyer would whisper in his ear from time to time, but not very often.
So what happens next?
Well, very interesting. I mean, this is obviously good news for Lionel Tate and his family. I'm sure the family of the victim is, you know, understandably disturbed by this. But it's not the best news Lionel Tate could have gotten. The best news for him would have been clemency, being granted clemency, because now he's in a position where he may be released in 15 days and until the next trial. And if that happens, he's in a position of standing trial again. And if he's convicted of first-degree murder, it's back to life without parole.
Is he possible that he would be offered a plea agreement again?
I think that's possible. We'll have to wait and see. I'm not entirely sure about that, but I think it's certainly possible. There was one offered the first time, and in that plea deal, he would have been out by now.
Mm-hmm. And again, the issue of clemency, that would come from the governor, wouldn't
it? That's right.
Okay. Now, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Dana Kennedy is an assistant national editor with the New York Times. She covered the Tate trial when it happened in Florida. She joined us now from the New York Times offices in New York City. We're going to move just a few decks over at the Times and bring in Adam Liptak. He's covering the Lee Boyd Malvo case for the newspaper. And thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Now, Lee Boyd Malvo was considerably older than Mr. Tate. Has his age played a role in his trial thus far?
He was only 4 months shy of his 18th birthday when the terrible sniper shootings in the Washington area happened last fall. And so he's almost, by most legal standards, an adult, but not quite. His lawyers have made very heavy use of the fact of his relative youth and what they say was his extreme immaturity, because their entire defense is focused around the proposition that the older sniper suspect, John Muhammad, indoctrinated him, brainwashed him, and essentially caused him to become insane to the point where he can't distinguish between right and wrong. And that theory relies very heavily on child psychologists and others who will say that it was because of the age difference between the men and because of Malvo's youth and immaturity that he was susceptible to that kind of brainwashing.
And Malvo is a young-looking 18.
He looks like a kid. He looks like a well-cut, alert, appealing, looking kid in oversized sweaters. He looks like somebody who could be a high school senior, which I suppose is how old he is.
Now, how much of his defense, as you say, they're suggesting that because he was young and easily influenced, he came under the spell of John Muhammad.
That is the entirety of the defense. They concede Malvo's involvement. There's some question about who shot whom and who was the shooter and who was the spotter, but there's no question that Malvo, by his own current account, shot some people. By some very chilling confessions played in court, he said he shot all of the people. The tapes revealed him to be bright, thoughtful in a very chilling sort of way, heartless, laughing. And that's a heavy burden to overcome, but their entire defense is based on this brainwashing equals insanity equals either please acquit him or at least spare him the death penalty.
A large part of the testimony by some of the psychiatrists and psychologists who've spoken with him is that he has, in a sense, been deprogrammed since he's been away from John Muhammad.
That's right, and moreover, they explain the confessions away by saying Muhammad not only programmed him to kill, but programmed him to self-destruct, as it were, if captured, and take the blame and take the fall. And people who sit in court and jurors who've now been watching this testimony for weeks may think that the individual building blocks by themselves may not persuade you, but cumulatively, the kid did go through a rough period and then a very intimate association with the first adult who really ever took an interest in him.
And in court, has he shown any remorse at all?
There were early in the trial, during the prosecution case, several people whom he shot or whom Muhammad shot who came on and testified and survived. And you could tell the expression on his face was a profoundly conflicted one, one which seemed to convey that the gravity of what he participated in was weighing on him. But in general, I have to say that he is... He's cheerful, he's goofy, and he doesn't quite seem to get the gravity of what's going on around him.
And again, the same question that we were speaking about with Dana Kennedy, does he engage in the proceedings? Does he interact with his lawyers?
My sense is that unlike Lionel Tate, he has a very clear idea of what's going on. There have been, on at least one occasion, Malvo has offered a significant strategic suggestion to his lawyers, and they seem to work with him constantly.
Now, Virginia is one of the last states to have the death penalty for convicted criminals under the age of 18. That's why a lot of people think Virginia was chosen as the site for this trial. Is this case causing renewed questioning of that policy?
Well, you can really make either argument from this case. There are those who say that this shows you why you should occasionally, in very rare instances, have the death penalty even for people under 18, because some crimes are so horrible they justify it. There's another school of thought that says this proves that younger people, not yet fully formed developmentally, can be so immature that they should not be held accountable, at least to the extent of being put to death, as adults might be. You could truly make either argument from the Malvo case.
We're going to be hearing both sides of that in a few minutes from a researcher and from a district attorney. But I wanted to ask you also about the politics of this. These are obviously heinous crimes that we're talking about here. There is a demand for justice, and at the same time, political capital perhaps to be made by trying this particular juvenile as an adult.
Well, there's absolutely no question that John Ashcroft's decision to send both men, but particularly Malvo, to Virginia was driven by the fact that this was the only jurisdiction in the Washington area shootings, at least, that could put him to death. And he said as much. And you can call that political, you can call it principled, but it was the driving force. And, of course, local prosecutors have a lot to gain by succeeding, as it were, in a high-profile case. So politics does, run through these cases.
And a lot to lose if the community is outraged that they seem to have let somebody off easily.
True enough. Now, the other thing we're going to see here is that Muhammad and Malvo at the moment are being tried for one killing each. There will be a series of trials right behind this one. Bob Horan, who's prosecuting Malvo, has told me that the next step will be to flip the two and to try Muhammad for the killing that Malvo's being on trial for, and vice versa. So even if they happen not to succeed on this one, there is a fairly strong chance that some jury somewhere will both convict and sentence both men to death.
But would that cause a conflict even in the state of Virginia, where you're getting different? Wouldn't that eventually end up in front of the Virginia Supreme Court?
It will go to the Supreme Court, but there will be prosecutions for different individual killings, and it would be possible to reconcile different results in different killings.
Thanks very much.
You bet. Good
Adam,
to be with you.
Thank you. Adam Liptak is covering the Lee Boyd Malvo case for the New York Times. We reached him in New York today at the Times offices, and we appreciate his time. We're talking about teenagers in the justice system. When we come back, we'll look at what we know about how teenagers think and how that plays out in the courtroom. If you've had experience with juveniles in the court system, we'd like to hear about your experience. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. The address there is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about teenagers in adult courts and how new science about brain development intersects with the demands of the legal system. Of course, you're invited to join our discussion. If you've raised a teenager or been one recently, how can you judge when an adolescent is ready to take responsibility for him or herself? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his home in Gladwin, Pennsylvania, is Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. He also directs the MacArthur Foundation's Project on Adolescent Development and Juvenile Justice. And thanks for coming on the show.
Sure. Happy to be here.
We talked earlier about the Lionel Tate case and whether he was competent to stand trial. What are the criteria for competency?
Well, under the U.S. Constitution, a criminal defendant has to have a rational and factual understanding of the proceedings, and that typically would involve understanding the charges against him or her, understanding the roles of the different people in the courtroom, the difference between a judge and a defense counsel, for example, what a jury does, and the ability to engage in more complicated decision-making, like knowing whether to accept or turn down a plea bargain offer.
And that was, of course, a key element in the Tate decision yesterday.
That's right. That's right. The court ruled that Tate should have had his competence evaluated before proceeding to trial. And I think that ruling is very consistent with evidence from our own research indicating that a very high proportion of children who are between 11 and 13, that was the age range where Tate was when he was tried, a very high proportion of kids in that are seriously impaired, that is, as impaired as mentally ill adults who have been found incompetent to stand trial.
And their brain is simply not developed to the point where they can participate in their own defense.
Well, the brain, and perhaps more importantly, their reasoning abilities. We don't have to get into the imaging of the brain to demonstrate that 13-year-olds lack the logical reasoning abilities of adults. They also lack a lot of the factual information that one needs to be a competent defendant. Now, this isn't true for all 13-year-olds, but what our research says is that a high enough proportion of them are impaired that, at the very least, a 13-year-old's competence ought to be evaluated before going ahead.
Now, in the Malvo case, again, a boy who was much older, 17 at the time of the incidents, and now 18 as he's facing trial, yet his defense rests on the idea that as a youth he was particularly malleable and vulnerable to manipulation by an older man, John Muhammad.
Yeah, there's an important difference between these two cases that sometimes gets lost in the discussion. In the Tate case, the issue was his competence to stand trial. In the Malvo case, the issue is his criminal blameworthiness or his culpability, which really has nothing to do with his state of mind now that he's on trial, but has to do with his capabilities and his capacities at the time that the crime was committed. And the argument here is that because of his developmental immaturity, he was less able to resist the coercive pressure of John Muhammad than an adult would have been in the same situation.
Less able, but I guess it's up to the jury to decide whether less able should have at least allowed him to say this would be wrong.
That's right, and I think that it's important to distinguish between the use of this argument as a way of arguing for Malvo's complete innocence, that is to say he was not responsible at all for what happened, versus the use of this argument to argue for mitigating circumstances which would lead to a lesser sentence, perhaps not the death penalty, but a long prison sentence instead.
And another important distinction is in Florida, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, it is life without parole. In Virginia, there is some more sentencing flexibility, and that varies from state to state and jurisdiction. So we have to bear that in mind as well. Let's get some listeners involved. Paul joins us now on the line from Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have a point to make. I'm 27, and I have a 14-year-old brother, which I've raised because his father was not around. And even though I have a lot of control over my brother as far as him agreeing with my point of view, and, you know, I have control over him, but he also has enough of his own mindset to make his own decisions and to disagree with me at points. Now, I think at 14, he's developing his mind and making his own opinions. But at 17, I would imagine that he would, you know, have a lot of his own thoughts and opinions and ideas. And at 17 years old, I think you're old enough to know that shooting people out of the trunk of a car is it's wrong. It's wrong to do so. I really don't think there should be an argument here in the Malvo case. I think that he should be tried and he should be convicted because he did something wrong. And I really, you know, even though Muhammad might have had some control over him, I think he knew what he was doing. And I think that having an argument here is just ridiculous. Thank you. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
You're welcome.
Lawrence Steinberg?
Well, I think the listener raises the usual concern. That is, didn't he know right from wrong? Well, probably, almost of course, a 17-year-old knows right from wrong, and that's not really the issue. The issue was whether he was able to resist the pressure to do something that he knew was wrong anyway. And what research on this shows is that adolescents are much more susceptible to coercive pressure than adults are. Now, whether he was susceptible enough to say that he ought to be sentenced less harshly if he's convicted is the issue before the jury.
And when you say coercive pressure, are we talking about the go on, I dare you, don't be a chicken kind of a deal?
Well, I think, you know, in some instances it's the go on, I dare you, don't be a chicken. But in others, as in this case, it's the coercive pressure of an adult with whom he's formed an apparently very deep emotional bond. Lots of teenagers do, of course, disobey their parents, but the vast majority of them do what their parents ask them to do. And if he was, coerced by Muhammad, driven around, I mean, here's a Malvo's situation. He was taught how to shoot by Muhammad. He was taken in a car, driven around the country, completely dependent on Muhammad for his food and for his well-being, and then driven to the scene of the crime. Now, if that's not coercion, I don't know what is.
Let's get another call in. This is Abby, who's with us from Honolulu in Hawaii.
Hello there.
Hi.
I basically agree with many of the comments that have already been made. I want to say that I think that what we need to recognize when we're talking about young children is that development has a variable rate. Children mature, children develop at very different rates just in the normal course. And we can't predict just by chronological age whether or not a child, a young adolescent, is going to be competent. I think it depends on maturity level of the individual child. It depends on the intelligence and the reasoning ability. It depends on the learning experiences that the child has gone through. I think it's important that kids experience appropriate consequences for their actions and behaviors, but I think we need to treat them very carefully. I think we need to do a careful individual evaluation. I'm not sure I would stop at age 13. I think I would go a little further than that in terms of looking at a need to do an individual complete evaluation of whether or not the child really is competent. My stepdaughter was probably competent at 14 or 15, but she's gifted.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of kids that are not competent at 16 or 17.
Lawrence Steinberg, I'd like to get a comment from you on Abby's point, but also to fold into the mix, the legal system is involved here, and in a lot of ways it doesn't have that kind of flexibility.
That's true. Now, I agree with Abby in the idea that there's a lot of variability, and we can't use chronological age alone to make these decisions. However, the law has to use chronological age for some guidance. There are 13-year-olds who probably can drive, and there are 19-year-olds who shouldn't be behind the wheel, but we pick 16 in most states because it's a reasonable age. That said, our research would indicate that probably kids who are 15 and younger ought to have their competence evaluated in a large number of cases before going to trial.
And I'd absolutely agree.
But so what we're not saying that somebody like Lionel Tate should be deemed incompetent just because he's 13. What we're saying is that 13 is an age that ought to send up a flag that says we ought to evaluate this person's competence before going ahead.
Hmm. Abby, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And Lawrence Steinberg, we appreciate your time today.
Sure, thank you.
Lawrence Steinberg, a professor of psychology at Temple University. He also directs the MacArthur Foundation's project on adolescent development and juvenile justice. We spoke with him at his home in Gladwin, Pennsylvania. And with us now is Joshua Markey, the district attorney for Astoria, Oregon. He joins us from his office there, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
States have different ways that juveniles end up in adult courts. Can you take us quickly how it works in Oregon?
In Oregon, as a result of a popular initiative about 10 years ago, and also as a result of some particularly horrifying crimes committed by 16- and 17-year-olds, If a person 15, 16, or 17 commits a murder, a homicide, or a very violent rape or assault, they're automatically remanded into adult court. They're tried as adults, but they are sentenced to serve their time, most of their time, if not all their time, in a juvenile facility. The courts have the ability to remand, and as in many states, children as young as 12 into adult court, but that has to be done by a judge who has to specifically determine that the juvenile system basically has nothing left to offer that juvenile. There's many systems across the country. Michigan has a blended sentencing system where someone can be tried as an adult, and then at age 18, the judge decides whether that person should be continued to be treated as a juvenile or sent to the adult system. But even in Florida, if someone is convicted at Lionel Tate's age, they are not in an adult facility. I think sometimes that's not made entirely clear.
How much discretion do you have as a prosecutor?
Like most prosecutors, I have a considerable amount of discretion. I mean, the main decision is made, of course, by the criminal who decides to commit X offense, and the other decisions are made by the legislature, or in this case, the people, who decide that they're going to say that at X age, that's the age of majority. But if I don't feel, for example, it's appropriate for a 16-year-old, for example, to be facing a mandatory adult sentence, I have the ability to charge that juvenile as a juvenile and not charge them in the adult system.
Now, what about the role of parents for these teenagers? Are they, in loco parentis, are they making decisions, or is the accused making his own decisions?
No, under certainly my state's law, and I believe most states, I serve on the board of directors of the National DA's Association. This is a subject of considerable discussion. If you treat someone as an adult, they have all the rights of the adult and all the responsibilities of an adult. They make those kinds of decisions. I have prosecuted a 16-year-old or someone who was 16 when he committed an aggravated murder. We had competency hearings, lengthy ones. They went on for weeks. He was found to be competent. He demonstrated many of the same behaviors that the New York Times reporter from Florida was describing Lionel Tate having. But the court found, and I had no doubt, that he understood exactly what was going on, and he ended up being found guilty, and he's serving life without the possibility of parole.
Here's an email question we have from Dan Cook. There's one thing that virtually all juveniles tried and sentenced as adults have in common, he says, race. They are virtually all black in all jurisdictions throughout the United States. Is that accurate?
That's patently false in Oregon. In fact, the proportion of juveniles that are prosecuted under the mandatory sentencing law in Oregon is actually slightly less in that than it is for other crimes. It is true that people of color tend to be overrepresented in our criminal justice system, but I don't think there's anything inherently racist in the idea of holding violent younger older teenagers accountable for very serious behavior. In the past, we said, okay, they're children, and then we came to realize that it was just plain ridiculous treating a 16- or 17-year-old who commits a violent series of rapes, maybe even a murder, and putting them in a facility with 13- and 14-year-olds who just literally need guidance. That didn't help that certainly didn't help the younger kids, and it was not a particularly good idea for the older offender as well.
We're speaking with Joshua Markey. He's a district attorney in Astoria, Oregon, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line, and this is Kit, who's with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Okay.
Just very quickly, I've worked in the domestic violence field for about 18 years, and the things that I have seen with regards to family violence have been hair-raising. I remember working with a woman who, her husband earlier in the day had planted his footprint in her face, and I stopped by her house after court to look at her hospital records and that sort of thing and check on her and see how she was. And as I was sitting in her living room looking at these records, she had a toddler that was sort of just moving about in the living room, and I was sitting in the chair looking at these discharge papers and talking with her, and this two-year-old walked over and tried to pull the papers out of my hand, and I wasn't done reading them, so I didn't let go. And when I did not let go, this little kid very clearly balled up his fist and punched me in the nose. And I think that, the common denominator to me for all these cases is the family life, or the lack of a family life, or the lack of good modeling behavior. These kids are growing up exposed to such extreme levels of violence. I don't see how it's appropriate for us to have an expectation that they are going to turn out differently, because they don't know any differently. And this is not to to excuse violent behavior, believe me, but I think we've got to take the pink bow off of the American mythology about families and start to look at what's going on in some of these very, very troubled families.
I would agree with the caller that, the vast majority of young people we see in the system for violent crimes come from, at best, dysfunctional homes, in many cases ones in which extraordinary amounts of abuse directed at them or other people exist. But that does not take away from responsibility and accountability. And I think it's important to note the vast majority of children who grow up in really abusive environments do not go on to rape and molest and injure and kill other kids or other people.
Yeah, and I'm not making excuses for these violent kids. I just think that we have to look at things realistically as opposed to, you know, some of the some of the mythology that's out there about all the families in America being these perfect intact American families when in fact they're not. And I've also worked with kids that have grown up and gone on to be incredibly wonderful adults that don't do any criminal behavior at all. But I think a certain element of these children, when they believe that violence is the way that you accomplish things because it's what's been modeled for them, I just think we need to be realistic about what our expectations should be.
Kit, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, I did want to ask, we heard earlier today about what psychologists know about youth brain development and how that's changing. Does science make its way into the courtroom, or is this strictly a legal legislative issue?
Well, sometimes good science makes its way in and sometimes junk science. Dr. Steinberg's research is funded by something called the MacArthur Foundation, which mm-hmm. is very much against the death penalty and against mandatory sentencing. And I'm sure he sincerely believes what he's saying, but there is considerable dispute about whether or not teenagers' brains are so unformed. I try mostly adults, and most of the time when I hear the excuse given for them, it's that they have considerable emotional immaturity. If we were to determine someone's emotional age and punish them accordingly, we probably wouldn't be treating 50 to 60% of the adult criminals in their 20s and 30s as responsible. As one of your previous guests said, we have to draw a line. We say this is the point at which we're going to hold you responsible, and in certain offenses, we're going to allow the courts to go lower than that. And Lionel Tate, just to add to the last caller's comment, came from a relatively middle-class home. His mother is a Florida state trooper. He did not come, it was a single-parent home, but it was not an extraordinarily dysfunctional or violent one.
We've got a couple of more calls. Could you stay with us after
sure.
the break? Okay. That's Joshua Marquis, who's a prosecutor in Astoria, Oregon, so we'll take some more calls after we come back from the break. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We're discussing how adult courts deal with younger defendants, and a little later, reach out and touch your keyboard. Is the future of phone calls actually online? We'll talk about internet telephone service. Can you already dial us through your computer? If you can, the number is 800-989-8255. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about young defendants in adult courts. Does the system need adjustment? Our guest is Joshua Marquis. He's district attorney in Astoria, Oregon. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Jillian, who's with us from Oswego, New York.
Hi, yes. Thanks for having me on the program. I'm calling because when I was in high school, I had the opportunity to work as a youth court member. And if you're not familiar with that program, it's a program where high school students serve as the court for first-time juvenile offenders of nonviolent offenses. And what I noticed with those kids, and we're not even talking about murderers, mm-hmm. was there were lots of indications, even with kids who shoplifted, that there was a problem. I think once the kids get to the point where they've committed a murder, the system has failed them so many times. And if we can get to them earlier, we can do things for them that will keep them from getting to that point. And I think once they get to the point where they've committed a murder, we owe it to them to do everything possible to rehabilitate these kids.
The system may have failed them, yet if they've committed a murder, surely they have done something terribly, terribly wrong that they should be held responsible for one way or another, don't you think, Jillian?
I do, but I think that we can better serve them and society by trying to rehabilitate them. The problem that we have a lot of times with people who commit murders is we think of them in the way we think, but those kids have never been shown what's right and what's wrong. And when the kids I dealt with in youth court, and like I said, those were relatively minor offenses, you knew, you know, that this was coming from way back. With these kids, somebody knew and didn't do something. And as society, we owe it to them to try and rehabilitate them, especially when you're talking about 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds who commit a murder. There's something else going on there. And society isn't served by locking them up for, you know, life or for 25 years or anything. That doesn't help anybody.
Well, Joshua, Mark,
I think Jillian's being a little bit naive. We have peer court, and I think it does work for juvenile offenders. I, unfortunately, have dealt with a lot of murder cases, a few involving younger people under the age of 18. Fortunately, it's very rare for a 12- or 13-year-old to commit murder. That's why so much attention has been paid to the Lionel Tate case. But 16-, 17-year-olds is not. One of the things that people have to accept is there are people, including young people, who are sociopaths. They have personality disorders, and no amount of rehabilitation and no amount of mothering and nurturing is going to make them better people. We lock them up not because it's going to rehabilitate them, but it simply incapacitates them for a period of time, and during that time, they won't be able to hurt anybody else. Now, they constitute a very tiny percentage of offenders, but they're a very dangerous group of offenders, and some of them are 16 and 17 years old.
But what do you do with the offenders who are, you know, 15 or 16 and commit a murder, not a sociopath? Sociopaths, I think, in any point of the justice system fall into a completely different category, even when you're dealing with adults. But what about the 16 or 17-year-old or the 15-year-old? This is their maybe...
their first murder?
...serious offense. And they could benefit from rehabilitation. How do you deal with them when everybody's out for blood and they want to have them dealt with, you know, in the worst way possible, when this person could be rehabilitated and maybe by the time they're 25 or 30 live a productive life and maybe even help other people?
Well, rehabilitation, I think, works for many offenses. When you get up to the point where somebody has committed murder, I'm not sure if rehabilitation is really going to be, I think we're not talking about one very important group of people, which is victims. And fortunately, if a juvenile in Oregon, for example, is convicted of manslaughter, they will be sent to a juvenile facility for as long as perhaps 7 or 8 years and receive treatment as a juvenile, and then they'll go out in the world. They'll be out and about when they're 25 years old. They'll be out of prison.
Jillian, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And Joshua Marquis, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Joshua Marquis is a district attorney in Astoria, Oregon, and we reached him at his office there.